This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on November 12th. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. The Texas Tribune reports that the Texas legislature has concluded its task of revising voting districts in the state based on a decade of population growth. The final product yielded district boundaries that solidify Republican dominance while weakening the influence of voters of color. Since 2010, Texas gained 4 million residents, 95% of whom are people of color. Nevertheless, in redrawing their maps, the majority party found ways to divide communities of color so as to diminish their voice. Consequently, the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus has filed a federal lawsuit alleging that the revised maps were designed with discriminatory intent and that they violate the Voting Rights Act. The caucus says that the lawsuit attempts to redress once again Texas' sordid pattern of racial discrimination. On the local Austin scene, the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission also recently concluded its charge to revise maps of city council districts. By contrast, the City Commission endeavored to maintain neighborhoods and communities to the greatest degree possible, and they explicitly call out adherence to the Federal Voting Rights Act. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guests this evening are Christina Puentes and Luis Gonzalez, the chair and vice chair, respectively, of the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission, or ICRC, for the city of Austin. The commission recently concluded its work, so tonight we'll hear how it all turned out. Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of this program, also joins us. Glad to have you back, Christina and Luis. How you been?
We are so good, so relieved to have certified the maps and just get to the final report. We made it.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you.
Maybe you could lead off and tell us a little about yourselves, remind our audience who you guys are.
Sure. So I am the chair of the commission, and you mentioned why we got into this work, this volunteer work, I should say. And I'm just somebody who pays attention to systems. When I found out that we had a redistricting commission that anyone could join, I was fascinated by the prospect of learning more about the redistricting system, since a lot of times it's just behind smoke and mirrors, behind closed doors. And it's kind of this broken political system that I think we're all pretty familiar with when we're hearing about gerrymandering, when we're hearing about what's happening at the state level. And so I look at what the root of the problem is, what's eating away at democracy. And I know this is a little bit of an oversimplification, but the answers I chose to focus on were the corrupting influence of money and then gerrymandering. And so gerrymandering hinders democratic participation and representation. And so I'm here to try to undo a little bit of that, at least at the local level and with the lens of historically oppressed people. So again, when I saw this opportunity come up, anyone could apply to be on the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission that lets the people draw Austin's city council districts. I had to give it an honest shot.
Well, thank you for your service there. And Luis, tell us a little about yourself.
Thank you again, Bob, for having us back. My name is Luis Gonzalez. I had the honor to serve on the ICRC as its vice chair this go around. I am a South Texas small town boy who moved to Austin for college and have lived in the city since 2009, seeing the rapid changes that over the last 10 years. In 2020, the COVID year, I applied to a program called the ATX Accelerator. It's a program that molds individuals who have a passion to run for local office, specifically that of city council. In that program, I learned about the consequences and the importance of redistricting, and I saw the opportunity to apply for the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. I was tired of my normal response to politics as usual, and I realized that this ICRC opportunity had direct impact, and I would be able to make change as we were drawing city council boundaries. So I'm always one who wants to learn. I have an administrative management background in my career, and I approach the ICRC as its vice chair to just get us across the finish line. I'm very happy that we certified the map on October 27th. It's the job well done of 14 strangers that came together to ensure that an apolitical process remained strong and remained a model for cities nationwide. I hope other cities will adopt what Austin is doing in terms of redistricting.
Well, tell us a little about the process. If we could go back to the beginning, all this was born, if I recall, back in about 2013 when we took a vote to divide the city up into districts. Prior to that, all of the city council members had been at large, if I recall correctly. Maybe you could take it from there. What did that process entail, or what did it require once we decided to go to districts?
So you're absolutely right, Bob. The ICRC was created by citizen proposition, and we have the sole legal standing to create and adopt maps for the city of Austin's 10 single member districts. And those were created alongside the ICRC. So the districts we have today were implemented by the first ICRC in 2013. And the ICRC proudly maintains its independence from influence by the city council. That's a really important aspect of this commission. And just to recap, on October 6th, after weeks of deliberation and several drafts of the map, the commission voted unanimously to adopt a new map of Austin City Council districts that will be in place through 2031. And even against constraints of delayed 2020 census data that didn't come out until August, and the COVID-19 pandemic, obviously, the 2021 ICRC held over 40 open meetings, and that's including 20 public hearings across the city in person and virtually. And we certified the final map on October 27th, so we were able to meet the deadline of November 1st, which was set by the city charter. Redistricting encompasses a lot of aspects, from protecting the shape of neighborhoods to interacting with any other local jurisdictions that could be affected by mapping changes. The mapping itself, I think of, is just one component of the overall redistricting process. And the simple fact that we are an independent citizens redistricting commission means that our involvement as citizen commissioners protects the process from political gerrymandering. To the extent possible, our role here is to protect the geographic integrity of local neighborhoods, local communities of interest from being unnecessarily broken up. And the goal was to make it easier for Austinites to know that they and their neighbors are all within the same city council district, and if possible, the same election precinct, because it can be really disorienting to find out that the people who live across the street from you don't share your local representative. So we were trying to avoid that as much as possible.
Luis, do you think you succeeded in that?
You know, Bob, with the constraints that the chair just mentioned, the global pandemic, the fact that engagement may not have been as strong as we would have hoped. A February freeze at the beginning of our work. I am very proud of the map that we certified on October 27th. The map was created without any bias by the research and the hard work of 14 volunteers, with the public testimony of those who joined us at those 20-some forums as the base for our redrawing. We also relied strongly on the work of the 2013 Commission. We would have had a choice at the beginning to completely start from scratch or use the 2013 map as a base. And I'm very happy that we stuck to a lot of what the 2013 map drafted, just because of all the constraints we mentioned. We were up against delayed census data. We had to get this map approved by November 1st. With all that said, the learning curve that we needed going into this process, I thought it was going to be a city-led initiative. Maybe I ignored what the independent in the ICRC really meant. But after being thrown in the bathwater, we learned really quickly. We were a commission that learned really quickly, and we got to the end goal. And I'm very proud of the map that will now be used in the 2022 elections.
So you guys had set up, as you alluded to, Christina, various community meetings, and you had some of those early on. And then after you came up with a proposed map, you had some more, correct?
Yes. So as mandated by the city charter, we held 10 public forums, one in each of our 10 city council districts. And those were in person mostly. As COVID started to ramp up and we got into stage 4, stage 5 of COVID protocols and all of that, we went more virtual, but we returned to in-person when we got to the second round of public forums. And this is after we had released the preliminary map. And then we had 5 forums, 4 that were in person, with one in each Travis County precinct, and then 1 virtual option because we are still in the middle of a pandemic.
And as I recall, the greatest participation or the greatest turnout for these meetings were the ones that were early on. Once you had come up with a map, it sounds like there was either great satisfaction or people had totally lost interest, but there wasn't a whole lot of objection to it all. Is that a fair assessment, Luis?
You know, Bob, I would say that was a fair assessment. I want to go back real quick. You know, Christina mentions the 10 forums that we had at the beginning, one in each district. We ended up doing 12. So adding a bit more, because we needed to take into account the virtual opportunities for those who were a little nervous about the pandemic. So I just want to state that even though the charter stated 10 forums at the beginning and then 4 the second time around and 2 the third time around, we added 4 additional forums to ensure that we were allowing as much engagement as possible during a global pandemic. Going back to the second round after the preliminary map, I actually feel that that first forum, I believe it was at the Gus Garcia Recreation Center, that had our most attendance. Mm-hmm. It had the most feedback, but you're right. Most of the feedback was positive, saying we've seen what you've drawn with the preliminary map and I'm here to support it. That quick, that fast. We had a bit of dissent, but that dissent was able to be corrected. Some neighborhoods were split up by the 2013 map, requesting to put it back together. We were able to accomplish some of those requests. So I feel because of the pandemic, because it wasn't the first time around, we are the second commission, maybe excitement for the process dwindled a little bit. But overall, I believe we got the feedback that we needed from those individuals, from those members of the public that were following the process. And again, that guided a lot of the work of the ICRC this time around.
Well, in looking back on the whole process, what are your thoughts about it? It sounds like you were fairly happy with the public forums. Were there other aspects that you felt really good about? On the other hand, were there problems or maybe things that you would have done differently?
You know, Bob, I'm really proud again of the work that these 14 strangers did together. Our first meeting was the first 8 commissioners that were randomly selected by the city auditor's office. And I will say, the first few months for those 8 commissioners was rather bumpy. I think we were going down a path without a leader, without a guide. And the city, you know, may have sat back and just watched us. but it was a really bumpy experience for those first eight commissioners. When we then selected the additional six, that six that included our chair, Cristina Puentes, I feel like then we started hitting our stride. You know, we elected a chair and a vice chair. We created subcommittees. We got work done, even with all the obstacles that we've already mentioned today. But I would advise the next commission to get the 14-person body together as quickly as possible, elect a chair and a vice chair as quickly as possible, and then hope, fingers crossed, that you do not have a global pandemic to deal with, a February freeze, a lack of engagement since it was a third time around. But keep your North Star and remember that all of our charter criteria, all of our deadlines are pretty cut and dry. They were written into the charter. So just focus on that. Remember that charter. And you'll learn, as I did, that the actual redrawing, the actual redistricting process is not that complicated. No matter what you see from the state or how political the state may want to make it, we needed to do our work by the census data, by a certain date, with seven criteria. It was pretty easy in my eyes.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, redistricting is not rocket science. I think it helped that our citizen commissioners all had a really diverse portfolio of professional backgrounds, all highly educated, as Austin tends to be. So yeah, that was, I think, a big lift. But I also think that with a couple of experts in the room, like our mapping specialist, George Corbel, any 14 people committed to this cause could have pulled it off. And that is the beauty of a citizens commission. Also, the traditional redistricting process has really distorted for the general public what it takes to draw new political boundaries. And like Louise said, through an independent process, we have learned how straightforward it really is to create a map that is not gerrymandered. The numbers, the data paint the story. And there's a lot of apprehension and distrust built around redistricting at the state and federal level, no matter where you go around the country. But really, there shouldn't be any mystery around this work. I think that was one of the biggest lessons, the biggest takeaways that I got from chairing this commission. There doesn't need to be any backroom wheeling or dealing. I think that this process just takes politics completely out of the equation. We're also talking about local elections that are nonpartisan. So we are a really pure model of what nonpartisan redistricting can look like. And this is how it should be.
So maybe the state of Texas could learn something here.
Oh man, let me tell you. Look, there are too many people telling us we shouldn't be participating in our democracy. Maybe they aren't saying those words, but they're saying it in their actions. And that's at any level of democratic participation. And I think that tells you everything you need to know about how important and special this commission is. One big contrast between Austin's redistricting process and the state of Texas's redistricting process is that the ICRC was formed out of a citizen petition and referendum simultaneously with the city's change to the 10-1 city council system, right? So at the state level, for better or worse, there is no vehicle for a public petition. So the only way the state would have any hopes of having a commission like this would be through legislation approved by the legislature, which in general, by virtue of the legislature being hyperpartisan, just presents issues right off the bat. I'll also say, for decades now, the state has redistricted through the Legislative Redistricting Board. And the ICRC, in contrast, is made up of 14 non-elected volunteers who have no ties to local politics. The LRB is made up of the Lieutenant Governor, Dan Patrick, the Attorney General, Ken Paxton, the Comptroller of Public Accounts, Glenn Hagar, and the Commissioner of General Land Office, George P. Bush, and also the Speaker of the House, Dave Phelan in this case. And we have no ties to politics. And we've also proven a level of impartiality to serve on this commission. I think, again, that's just the beauty of our process. It's open, it's transparent, You can read notes. You can watch our meetings on every conversation the commission has ever had about redistricting. And public input was an enormous driver in our decision making. So the citizen participation actually mattered rather than this feeling of I'm going to the Capitol, I'm taking a day off work to testify for 2 minutes on a bill. And I know that I've been there. It falls on deaf ears, right? Like you're trying to be civically engaged, but you're not feeling the impact of it. I think with this commission, you can draw straight lines from testimony from the public and decisions that were made on the maps and the rationale for that.
Yeah. You know, if I may, Bob, the last part of Christina's comments here about the importance of public testimony, I think that's the biggest difference between what I learned, what goes on at the state level and what could go on the city level. We talked about the forums. We scheduled the forums where the people are, not the other way around. We went to each of the districts. We went to each of the county precincts. We went north of the river, south of the river. We went virtual. We wanted to ensure that we were making this process as smooth and easy as possible for those folks who wanted us to hear their thoughts and their opinions. We offered our documents in multiple languages. We had physical printouts of maps at the public libraries where folks could fill out the survey, turn it into the library, and then it would come back to us. We had a website where you could submit your own map. All of our public meetings, all of our minutes are available on the city website. So it's a very transparent and open process, as Christina mentioned. And I think that is the fundamental difference of what the city of Austin did, what our commission did, and what the state just did in ensuring that people of color have a smaller voice than they're entitled to based on their growth and the 2020 census data.
Given that both of you are new to this process, I'm guessing that you may have underestimated the amount of work that it would entail. Is that a fair assessment? And, you know, as you look back on it, do you have any regrets about getting involved in this at all?
No regrets, Bob. But, and I've used this saying a few times, so apologies if I repeated myself here with you. But when I was one of the first 8 selected to be on this commission, I thought it was a huge honor. I was not expecting it. But maybe it's because I do pretty good in raffles. Who knows? But when I was first selected, it was an honor to be nominated. And then again, I felt when I took my oath and it was the first 8 commissioners, we were just left to our own, you know, sink or swim. And we had to quickly learn. I have a full-time job on top of this. My advice would be if you're applying to be on the 2031 commission, just really understand what this process takes. It takes a lot of homework. It takes a lot of late hours. All of our Wednesday meetings were from 6 to 8 or 9 p.m. You're giving up Saturdays to hold public forums on a day that most of the public could attend. So I didn't know how much work would go into it, but I quickly learned as soon as I took my oath that, oh, wait, this is not a city-led initiative. This is a completely independent body. We had to learn Robert's rules. We had to hire our legal staff. We had to hire an administrative manager to ensure that we could get through the day-to-day, whether it was scheduling meetings or subcommittee work progressing. It was a lot, but no regrets. I'm very proud. I'm honored to have served my city, and I look forward to the next opportunity to do so, actually.
I would add also advice, hit the ground running, diff out the strong leadership among the group as soon as the commission is made whole at 14 members. Don't be afraid to ask for help from whomever, whether that's the city, the community, leaning on each other for support, whichever avenue will help you get the job done. But at the same time, ground everything that you're doing in your exclusive independence from political influence and from the city, because like Luis mentioned, you get to hire your own administrative and legal staff and largely dictate your own operation. The city cannot tell this commission how to do its job, and we're unique from the other 70 boards and commissions that the city has in that way. And, you know, by the way, hire your staff as early as possible so that you volunteers are not stuck doing all of the administrative tasks and legal guesswork. Just stick to the guidelines of the charter, the North Star, and then as a body, you can figure out the rest and ground everything you're doing in the people of Austin. This is for Austinites. This is for our access to fair representation. And finally, I would just say, have fun getting to know each other, because there is no experience like volunteering on a citizens redistricting commission.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Michelle, did you have anything you wanted to add here?
I would have gone back to the beginning just to ask, to reiterate who actually chose the first 8 people and how that was done, just kind of to remind us, since we talked about the fact that you're an independent council here for the city, but ultimately somebody within the city has to choose who those first 8 are and how that process worked.
The city opened up the process for applications. After that process closed, there were a little more than 300 applications that were received for placement on the ICRC. What the city auditor's office did was selected 3 CPAs. They went through all of those applications and they narrowed down to the 60 most qualified applicants. So these 3 CPAs still had to apply for their position in this review process. They chose the 60. From those 60 most qualified, the city auditor's office had a day where they announced a raffle and they chose random numbers associated with each of those 60 names. And that's how the first 8 were selected, just like a lottery system. Those first 8 then selected the additional 6 based on qualifications, ensuring that the diversity of Austin was represented on the commission. And we were happy that we spanned age. I think our oldest commission was 80. Our youngest was 24, and she was our student representative. We had a good mix of male and female. We had a good mix of racial identity. And then those 14, we got to work in early February or so. Excuse me, the first 8 got the work started in February. I believe the 14 of us did not come together until May.
And you had to represent all 10 districts of Austin. At least one commissioner on the board had to be from each of the 10 districts. Is that correct?
You know, Christina, you may need to help me. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't believe that is required, but we as a commission wanted to ensure that was the case.
So it's not mandated in the city charter that we have representation across the 10 districts, but it is, I guess, a suggestion that the representation is broad across the city and across all of these various metrics that Luis had mentioned. And so we did pull off having at least one commissioner from each district.
We're speaking with Christina Puentes and Luis Gonzalez from the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission, or ICRC, for the City of Austin. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on November 12th. Our guests this evening are Christina Puentes and Luis Gonzalez, the chair and vice chair, respectively, of the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission, or ICRC, for the City of Austin. The commission recently concluded its work. Let's pick up where we left off.
I had a couple of thoughts on annexations. You mentioned dissent earlier. There were some queries about unannexed areas that border Austin.
If they're unannexed, they're not in the city. Is that correct?
Yes. So there are parts of Travis County that do not belong to any city or municipality. And in some cases, those unannexed areas are surrounded by Austin. They're just like this little bubble in the middle of the city, basically.
Right. Islands.
Right. Islands. And the trouble here is annexations are far less accessible than they used to be, since cities in Texas no longer have the latitude to annex without a majority of voters approving the annexation in a local election. And that was since Texas changed the law some years back in 2017 and then again in 2019. But the ICRC is a 10-year obligation for all 14 of its members. So if there were to be any future annexations between now and 2031, we would be brought back to work out those discrepancies, to formalize bringing that land into its adjacent city council district. And the ICRC is committed to that as long as we're alive and well in Austin. And if anyone were to leave the commission, we would reconvene to select a new member from that pool of 60 qualified applicants that Luis mentioned. And yeah, I mean, you know, again, about dissent, even though annexations only came up a handful of times from the public, this issue is something that I think really stood out to the commission. Some folks reached out to us to point out that their residence wasn't included in the map. And there was actually one gentleman who came to a handful of our forums, and he was not happy about the disenfranchisement that people experience in unannexed areas in South Austin that are surrounded by the city, like an island, like you mentioned. What it just feels like to go to the voting booth just to be told that they can't vote in city elections because they don't live in the city. And he wanted to see what the ICRC could do. And to be clear, we can only draw district boundaries for the city council. And we have no jurisdiction to take parts of the county that aren't Austin and make it Austin. But it was compelling to see the crossover of the ICRC's unique role in redistricting with the city's role in annexations and the state's role in what they permit cities to do.
Well, we're just about out of time. Any final thoughts on your experience or anything at all that we haven't discussed yet that you'd like to get in there?
Just that a big part of the ICRC's job is to draw a new map every 10 years. And we've explained, we kind of shared that that process in itself is pretty cut and dry. It is bound by a charter and you have a deadline. What I will say though, is that there's a lot more complexity when it comes to opportunity districts or annexed areas, or folks who are coming to the ICRC with concerns that are not within our scope of work. That is where a lot of the more interesting work, a lot of the hard work came from. You know, we talked about opportunity districts. We drew districts 1, 2, 3, and 4 with the help of leaders on the east side. But it's interesting to note that even District 1, which is the Black Opportunity District, only has about 23% of a Black population. So it is an opportunity district, the best that we could have drawn. I hope we could correct that in the future. I hope we could really look at why, for the first time, there was no voting tabulation district in the city of Austin that had a majority Black population. Again, that's outside the scope of the ICRC, as is housing prices and in the market and driving folks out. Just think about that when we're considering something like redistricting the city. It's not information we could have used, but maybe there could be some amendments in the future. Maybe we could not only use the 2020 census data when we know that there may have been an undercount this time around. So I'll leave it there, Bob.
And Christina?
No further comment. I just really appreciate the opportunity, Bob.
Well, we're so glad that both of you could join us today. Once again, congratulations on a job that, from an outside perspective here, a job that appears to have been well done and certainly very conscientious on your part. Congratulations and many thanks.
Thank you. We hope we've made Austin proud.
Yeah, thank you so much, Bob. We hope that the passion and the commitment to the ICRC will carry on for future commissions and that this process kind of lights a spark in cities across the country. So we really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate your service too.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
It's Friday afternoon, and once again, we have Austin Sanders with us, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How's it going today, Austin?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Just fine, thanks. Another beautiful Friday afternoon here. So I got a phone call from Greg Kassar a few days ago, and it was no surprise, but he's announced that he's running for Congress. I guess he has formally resigned his position as city council representative. Have I got that right?
Not quite. Basically, there's a state law The rule is known as resign to run. And if you're a city council member, county commissioner, some kind of like, you know, municipal office, and you announce that you're seeking a higher office in the legislature and Congress, you effectively resign your position. But so the position doesn't go unfilled, you can kind of continue to serve as council member. So Kassar has, you know, basically tendered his resignation from the city council, but he will continue serving as the city's District 4 representative until a special election is held and a new council member is elected and inaugurated, which is expected to happen sometime early next year. So, you know, people living in Council District 4 won't go without representation while their member runs for Congress, basically.
Got it. That makes sense. So he's not going to disappear from City Hall anytime soon, it sounds like.
Yeah, no. We'll see when the election will actually happen. Council is set to vote on an ordinance, basically vacating the seat and ordering the special election, which is tentatively scheduled for January 25th. So that's kind of the date that everyone is eyeing right now. If someone wins that race without a runoff, presumably they would be sworn in shortly after that, early February, in which case Kassar would be, you know, at that point done with City Hall and would be focusing full time on his congressional campaign. For the time being, he's got to split his time on both jobs.
Well, before we talk about the congressional race and the city council, the name Chito Vela has come up a little bit, right?
Right. Yeah. And he's a name. He's a figure that I'm sure your listeners are familiar with. He's a immigration and criminal defense attorney in town. He's lived here since the 90s and has had his own private practice since, I think, 2012 or so, again, practicing immigration and criminal defense law. And he's been active in kind of city politics for a number of years. He served on the Planning Commission, appointed there by Greg Kassar, from, I think, about 2015 to 2017. And there he kind of helps approve zoning cases, new housing and commercial developments that go to council seeking rezoning approval. So that's a real kind of nuts and bolts, nitty gritty type of volunteer city position. So he's pretty familiar with that aspect of city government. He was actually kind of considering a run for the District 4 seat last year, when some of your listeners may remember Greg Kassar himself was considering a run for Senate District 4. That's a state representative seat vacated by former Austin Mayor Kirk Watson when he left to be the dean of the public affairs school at the University of Houston, a position he's now left. But Kassar decided not to, you know, run for that seat. Chito held off, but now's his time. He's officially announced his candidacy and thus far remains unchallenged. It's definitely a seat that he's positioned well to win. He has, you know, deep roots in that district. He is, you know, a Latino man, grew up in Laredo before moving to Austin to attend the University of Texas. District 4 is a majority Hispanic district, and that's a, you know, a sizable percentage of the electorate there. He, you know, proved effective in earlier state house run. In 2018, Vela ran for House District 46, which sort of overlaps with Austin City Council District 4. He came very close to winning a primary against Cheryl Cole, who went on to win that election. She herself also served on Austin City Council. He came within less than 200 votes of winning that primary. So a really tight race that he proved effective at campaigning in. So he's really well positioned to win this seat. Again, he's unchallenged at this point. We'll see who steps up to face off against him. But he's already got, you know, a pretty wide array of support from kind of Austin political figures. He'll begin fundraising. And so he's kind of the candidate to beat at this point.
Chito's been on this program a few times. I think the last time was when we were talking about the DACA ruling. That would have been about a year ago, year and a half ago or so. And then you're mentioning his own roots in D4. Chito was actually the board chair for Workers' Defense Project for a few years. And I'm almost sure that he and Greg overlapped there. Greg was hired by Workers' Defense Project many years ago, and his job was City Hall liaison. So it was no surprise to those of us involved with Workers' Defense when he ran for city council. At any rate, it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out, but I totally agree with you that he's well positioned up in District 4 for sure. So forgetting about city council for the minute, now focusing on U.S. Congress, he'll be taking on Eddie Rodriguez in the primary. Is that right?
Yeah, Greg Kassar will. So basically, the reason Vela can run for this council seat, again, is because Greg Kassar announced on November 9th that he would be running for the newly drawn Texas Congressional District 35 seat. This was a seat that has been occupied for many years by Representative Lloyd Doggett. Doggett announced that he was going to run for a completely new congressional district in Texas, Texas 37. Thus far, I believe he's the only candidate, Democratic candidate, to run in that seat. And it's a similar district to 35, but it's more Travis County. Texas 35, and the seat that Kassar and Eddie Rodriguez will be running for, is primarily Travis County, but it takes up a good portion of Bayard County and San Marcos, San Antonio specifically, other parts of Hayes and Comal counties to the south of Travis. So it'll be an interesting face-off between Representative Rodriguez, who of course has been State House of Representatives member in House District 51 for more than 20 years. You know, he's been in the seat a long time and has worked with members of the San Antonio area Bayard County delegation for many years, who identifies as a progressive candidate as well. We'll see where the voters are in this primary, which will happen in March 2022, pending litigation against the new congressional map that the Texas legislature has approved. But, you know, we've got Greg Kassar kind of representing the newer, younger face of the Democratic Party. He's already received endorsements from the Working Families Party. This is kind of a national group that has worked with people like Bernie Sanders and other progressive candidates throughout the country. And Greg is kind of positioning himself as a squad member, squad adjacent, that being Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, and, you know, these members in Congress who are some of the more progressive members in Congress. That's where he's kind of running. Rodriguez, he's kind of still shaping up his campaign. He hasn't been in the race as long as Kassar. So we'll see what his angle is going to be. Definitely a progressive member. I saw that, like Kassar, he is embracing Medicare for all. He says that's kind of the direction that the Congress needs to head in terms of improving healthcare coverage for Americans. And that's kind of been a litmus test for progressives, right? Is support for Medicare for all. So they're on the same page there. But again, we're still very early into this campaign. I think something that's notable is State Representative Trey Martinez Fisher, who had been kind of eyed as potentially running for this Texas 35 seat. He's a San Antonio area State House member. He's a big name down in that part of South Central Texas. He could have been a sizable force, but he announced last week he's running for re-election for his State House seat and is endorsing Representative Rodriguez. So we've got a big figure in San Antonio politics stepping up to support his longtime colleague in the State House, while Kassar has lined up support from some of the newly elected San Antonio City Council members who, like himself, are highly progressive left-wing council members. So it's kind of an interesting support mix that these candidates are drawing, and we'll see how it plays out in the campaigns going forward.
And did I read in your article that several of the State House Dems have also lined up behind Rodriguez?
Yeah, that's right. At Rodriguez's campaign kickoff event, in attendance, there was Representative Celia Israel and Gina Hinojosa, Donna Howard, Cheryl Cole, all members of the Travis County delegation who have announced their support for Rodriguez, who some have worked with for many years, some for not as long, but have decided to support him in this race.
And at the same time, I mean, just to muddy the waters a little more, Celia Israel is talking about running for mayor of Austin, right?
That's right. Yeah. She announced that she won't be seeking re-election to her state house seat, which I don't think anyone has announced for that seat, but it'll be an open seat. So I'm sure it'll be competitive. But yeah, Israel has announced that she is interested. She has an exploratory committee looking at a run for mayor. So we'll see if she makes a decision on that soon.
This is all interesting, this shift in local politics here.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to a different topic. Earlier this week, there was a report from an auditor, was it, for the city that was looking at the city's response to Winter Storm Uri last February. How did that go?
Yeah, it was a pretty brutal report. The city auditor is kind of an independent office within the city. They report directly to city council. And as such, they have freedom to really explore a lot of issues. They look at city spending, city response to various policy directives. This was basically how the city responded to Winter Storm Uri. And yeah, it was a pretty scathing report. At the top of my story, I quote, and I'm reading from the report here, "The city was unprepared to respond to Winter Storm Uri, largely because the city did not adequately anticipate or plan for a widespread or severe winter storm." Basically, this is saying the city just was not prepared for this kind of storm. Much of the city's disaster planning revolves around flooding, which is kind of what we experience locally. And then to support hurricane evacuees, you know, we have a lot of from the Houston or Gulf region in general, evacuees from hurricanes coming to Austin during storm season, seeking shelter and other support. So that's a lot of our disaster planning. But the report also went on to say, while the storm was exceptionally severe, the city's lack of preparedness for Uri led to a less effective and disorganized response. And the report kind of pointed to a few different areas for why this was the case, why the city was so unprepared. One was, again, just the kind of the nature of this storm. It was kind of, we're not prepared for a severe winter storm. We don't have control over when ERCOT, you know, the state energy regulators, tell us to cut power and conserve power. We don't get to say we need to use this amount of power to give electricity to our residents. We kind of have to comply with those orders. But a really interesting part of the report was that it showed how little the city had responded to recommendations from prior after action reports of disasters. Basically, when a disaster occurs, the city responds. Departments do these after action reports to kind of say, here's how we could have responded more effectively. Here were our shortcomings. And they kind of compile all of these recommendations. Well, the auditor said the city did a poor job of implementing those recommendations, many of which could have helped the city be better prepared for Uri, even though it was a kind of unprecedented, extremely severe storm. So that was kind of a big issue. On Wednesday, the council's audit and finance committee was having a meeting where they were discussing this report. You know, several of the council members on that committee were really, you know, kind of exasperated in disbelief that so many of these recommendations could have gone unheeded, were just not implemented. So they were, you know, really urging staff to be more proactive in preparing city departments for the next storm. Many noted that we are approaching February 2022, and there is a question about how prepared we are if a similar storm hits. So there's more urgency behind implementing recommendations from prior reports than there had been in previous years.
I think I heard somewhere that my own representative, Allison Alter, had some rather scathing criticisms for city staff.
Yeah, I recall her characterizing staff's response to the auditor's report as defensive. And, you know, you have to agree. I can kind of get staff's perspective. You know, from their perspective, they were working in really difficult conditions. Many of city staff didn't have access to electricity or internet. They were dealing in their personal lives with the same kind of emergencies that all of us were while trying to carry out their really critical work duties. Of course, you know, as council members pointed out, perhaps working conditions may not have been as difficult if some of these recommendations from prior reports had been implemented.
Right. Well, you know, I think I think a lot of us are still experiencing something approaching PTSD on all this, you know. I know I'm not looking forward to the winter at all.
Yeah.
And I had it pretty good. I was only without power for a couple of days, water for about a week. At any rate, I'm not especially enthused about winter's return, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think you're right about the lingering effects that people who lived through the storm are still dealing with. To kind of tie our conversation back to the campaigns, when I talked with Greg Kosar and Chito Vela about their campaigns, they both mentioned the winter storm and preparing for the next one and tying it to future climate change disaster catastrophes to make sure our local infrastructure is better prepared and strengthened for these kinds of storms. So I really think we're going to see a lot of that from other political campaigns in this cycle, really reminding people of kind of the horror that many lived through during that storm and kind of using that as a campaign platform to say we need elected officials who are going to have us better prepared so we don't have to live through this really disastrous incident again.
I think a lot of us were hoping that the governor and the state legislature would implement more serious preparations against the sorts of failures that we experienced. But everything I've seen has just been a disappointment on that front.
Totally. Yeah. It certainly seems that the legislature kind of abdicated their duty here in the last session. They met for a long time, but focused on other issues beyond storm response.
Right. Well, you mentioned one other story. You said going back to 2018, there had been an APD shooting. Why is that in the news again?
Yeah, so 2018, outside of a club on 6th Street, 20-year-old Aquanis Griffin, a Black man visiting from Baton Rouge to watch his friend perform at a concert, was killed by 9 Austin police officers. There was an altercation happening in the club, spilled outside. There was guns fired. Initially, Griffin was unarmed. He ran from the scene and came back armed. And as he was kind of running back to the scene, encountered this line of officers, 9 of whom fired at him more than 40 times, according to attorneys representing Griffin's family in a civil lawsuit against the city of Austin. He was hit more than 30 times and died. And the reason this is in the news is because Travis County grand jury cleared the 9 officers involved in that shooting, basically deciding that it was a justified shooting because he was armed. And the officers say that he pointed the gun at them. The attorneys argue that he didn't point the gun at them in a threatening manner. Basically, what they say happened is he was running full speed back to the scene, saw the officers, kind of turned on a dime, and as he was turning, his arm moved and swung in the direction of the officers, at which point the officers opened fire on him. And they note there's cell phone video recorded by a witness of this that shows Griffin is shot a few times initially. He falls to the ground, and he's shot another 20 times or more. And family attorneys who have filed the civil suit really say that was unnecessary. You know, after the first shots, the officer should have proceeded to provide medical care, get EMS in there, because Griffin was subdued at that point. One of these civil suits was dismissed by a district judge in Austin, a federal judge. But the family attorney says that he intends to file a motion to reconsider, which basically could revive the case. If that fails, the family could appeal it to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to kind of seek civil justice that way.
Hmm. So that's yet another case of a civil suit against the city for police shooting.
Right. Yeah, just another one to the list.
Right. As always, we're very grateful for your reporting, and we'll stay on top of all this, okay?
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Up next here on coop.org and on the 91.7 HD3 channel, stay tuned for Youth Spin. That's all from us this evening. Stay safe, everyone.